Yeah. I just want to clear some language with you, mainly because I want you to say yeah back to me. And then I want to tell you a bit about what we've been doing with accessibility. But first of all, can anyone that's sort of involved in accessibility identify yourselves? The people, is accessibility something that some of you actually do in particular? Okay, a small number. What about metadata? Okay, so I'm not going to drive you all mad with things you all know, hopefully. So what I want to do is try and talk a little bit about the scope and context of the work in which I've at least been doing accessibility, talk about how those standards come about, give you a notion of metadata and the standards, and talk about what we're describing as the Access for All model. And I'm really keen to get some feedback, so please don't hesitate to boo or cheer to my comments. The first thing that I'm really concerned about is that in the work that I do with accessibility, I am trying to make sure that everyone gets access to information or resources or participation in the information age or whatever crazy thing we want to call it. And I am very concerned about the way we marginalise some people and describe them as having disabilities and then do special things with them, like usually relegate the problem of dealing with them to some small unit somewhere in the back blocks. In universities where I work some of my time, they have units to care about people who've got disabilities, but they don't seem to have a general notion of caring about everyone. And I think that's insulting to the people with disabilities, and I think it's actually wrong because most of us have disabilities. So I'm really interested in access for everyone, literally meaning everyone. In Europe, they're talking about constructed disability as well as the sort of physical medical disabilities. So when I'm driving my car and I'm lost and I'm desperately trying to get some instructions, I don't want to be picking up my phone and doing one of those SMSs where I do the best grammar to ask, how do I get there? I want to have something where I can just talk to it, get a response and keep using my eyes busy. My eyes should be on the road. I should be behaving like a blind person. In fact, I don't, because I tend to use my eyes in incorrect ways. So constructed disability is something that comes about from the context, and it's quite well established in Europe, and it might be because I'm a French person in Romania. My disability there might be language, might be because I'm driving a car and I'm a mobile user. It might be a bunch of different reasons. And I think that it's about dealing with everyone that is the important thing. The second thing is that I don't see a particular difference between the problems we have in education and the problems in every other context. And I certainly don't see any difference between the resources that we use in education and the resources that normal people use. So again, this kind of assumption that you can limit this to education can worry about people with disabilities because that's being equitable, doesn't work unless the government is publishing stuff in an accessible way, da-da-da-da. The third problem I have is this notion about what the web is. There's a lot of effort to make the web accessible. I'm sorry, I come from a long time of using the web, way before we had Mosaic and all these kind of wonderful web gadgets. The web, as far as I'm concerned, is all the stuff that's linked any old way, anyhow. Whether or not I've actually got access to it because maybe it's behind a firewall or maybe I haven't got something or other. But to me, the web of information is all digital stuff. And I think that's another problem that we've got. People tend to think about accessibility of web pages and make PDFs. You know, I just don't get it. People think about accessibility and they run Microsoft institutions. I don't understand how people at, for example, Melbourne University could possibly be expected to make accessible their resources when they constantly have to make sure that they work on IE. It's, you know. So I don't have to say a lot about that to you guys, but I do think we need to make that message very, very clear, that it's not just about resources accessibility, it's about hardware and software too. And one of the things that we've done in Australia is so narrowed the opportunities that some of the accessibility people I work with won't even come and work in Australia. The answer I got from a major player in the world this week was, no, Our company's not even interested in setting anything up in Australia because you're a Microsoft country. That's the end of that. Don't discuss it with us. And I think this is something that while we can run around being a little bit geeky and happy that we're all beginning to see the open source message and the standards message, a lot of people don't have any idea how important that message is. Accessibility is a funny thing because what you do has a better or worse effect depending on where you are. Legal jurisdictions make an enormous difference to what goes on. You know, this is something that we can't really get clear enough. What I do in Australia, I want to have it looked at by people in other countries. Their rules about accessibility might look the same, but be completely different because of the way their legal system works. And so there's a real problem. In Australia, there's a very negative support for people who need help with access to resources. You have to lodge a complaint. You have to prove a whole lot of stuff. It's like asking the girl that's just been raped to get up and do a whole lot of things. It's not a happy scene, and we don't actually get very good results from the legal system yet. So we've really got to think about that. And there is the United Nations Declaration that Australia helped to put together, and in typical form, what did the Australian government do? It said, well, that's very nice, we're glad there's a declaration. Yeah. See it. So what we need to work to do is have the Declaration of Human Rights, the latest piece of that, adopted in Australia as something that we're signatories to and something that we pass through our legislatures. And I think that's a really important thing, because if we had the same attitude to access to information and didn't carry on about, oh, we're coping with a few disabled people, but generally saw access to information as everyone's rights, then I think we would have a different approach from institutions, organisations, governments and so on. And I'm very hopeful that that will in fact happen with a new government. Let's cross our fingers. Okay, the other thing that I think is worth saying about accessibility is that there are two kinds of problems. We know, those of us are in this room all here because we care about technology, but we know that technological solutions aren't all that you need. You cannot solve the accessibility problem simply by being clever techies in corners. You have to do a lot of technical work, but you have to also have policies and strategies that support that technical work and getting the message out that a lot of people are still missing out. Do you know 3% of what's available is probably available to everyone who already has the right hardware, software, whatever. I'm not talking about the socioeconomic problem. I'm saying if I give you all the equipment that you could possibly ask for, only 3% of what's there will be accessible to people. That is pretty frightening. We are very much in an elitist information age, and I think that's pretty frightening. Okay, so let's try and get on. What goes on in Australia is that you are obliged as a public body or providing public information to make it accessible to everybody, but as I said, it's actually quite difficult to enforce that. So most people just say, yes, well, we're obliged, but our audience won't want that. We won't have anybody who's got a disability in our audience. We won't have to worry about it. Or even if we get into a lot of trouble like the Olympic Games did, with the Sydney Olympic Games website was not accessible, a blind person couldn't buy tickets for his family, then you might have to pay a fine. Ooh, $20,000. Well, don't worry about it. $20,000 is cheaper than making stuff accessible. Well, that's absolute bunkum, actually. And the other side of the story is that people who have taken accessibility, giving access to everything to everyone on board, is saving a lot of money now. So it's a little bit more work to get your plan right in the beginning, but you can actually publish and do things in a very accessible way and save money. And the best example I know of that was Fairfax, when they organised their newspaper by getting things, having images, describing what the images are, having bits of text, having proper descriptions of those things. They then could ship to people what they wanted instead of everything in the hope that out of this bundle you'll find something that'll work for you. Just ship the pieces that people wanted. Don't ship pictures to people who don't want to see them. And they save $1 million a year in transmission costs. Now, transmission costs are one of the smallest costs of in the whole system. But they save $1 million on transmission alone. So they've got plenty of money for making sure that they make their stuff accessible. The other interesting thing is that in this country, everybody is at risk if they don't think about accessibility properly. As an expert advising on IT and whatever, if your advice is taken because people think you're an expert, and it turns out that your advice doesn't actually say this thing should have been accessible, and somebody sues because it wasn't accessible, they can sue you personally. So a lot of the accessibility experts I know are saying, ooh, I'm not sure I want to put my plate up and say I'm an expert in this anymore, because it suddenly means I'm responsible. On the other hand, it means that their organisations need to pay more attention to them, I think. And what's more, the organisations are vicariously responsible. If the IT person gives the wrong advice and the thing isn't accessible and somebody suffers, then the organisation can be sued because of what we call vicarious liability, which is designed specifically to say the richest person pays for the problem. And my cursor ran away, so now how on earth am I going to find it back again? And so one of the things that we need to bear in mind, I think, is that accessibility has got to do with software, hardware and resources. And I think this is where you guys also have a great role to play. It's not just that we have to make something so that a blind person can find out what's in an image, but we have to make something so that a blind person can put images up online. A blind friend of mine recently had a birthday party and wanted to put pictures of his birthday party up. Couldn't get access to software that was standards compliant that would make it easy for him to do that. How ridiculous. So it's authoring tools and user agents, as we call the browsing sort of tools. So all of these things need to be standards compliant, and in general that means open source, because nobody else seems to make standards compliant ones. A few people do, but not many people. It's pretty surprising how few do. And so I think that we should be seeing lots of screaming and yelling in universities and TAFE institutions around this country, where people are saying, how could you possibly limit us to proprietary products? Because you're making it so that we've got problems and we're building in 97% inaccessibility for people. So there's some ranting and raving. Accessibility standards have an interesting history, I think, in that when people started using computers to print books, they actually established a way of storing their files, a format for giving to the book publisher. And it was obvious that you'd get this thing all ready, you'd then give the publisher from the editors and so on a file which would go to the publisher, which could then be squeezed into whatever book was going to be made and the way it was going to be done. And people used HTML. The interesting thing about HTML is that some of the people developing HTML were blind. And so they were smart enough to develop HTML so that there's a byproduct. You could make a book, or you could use the file to make some electronic text version that a blind person could read. So that was when accessibility was first thought of as the separation between presentation and content. Okay? And I think it's quite interesting to follow what's happened to that. The other thing that we all know is that there are lots and lots of formats for different things. So there are formats for kinds of pictures. Some formats are conducive to supporting people with disabilities. If I haven't got my glasses, or if I'm sitting in this lecture theatre and the writing's too small, I need the picture and the writing made bigger, not just the writing. As you know, most times that doesn't happen. But if you used SVG, for example, those images would get big along with the text. So there are formats which we can use in standards. I haven't been involved very much in those, except at the beginning when W3C started thinking about that. But there are lots of formats around there that we can pick and choose between, and we seem to pick the wrong ones most of the time. I find it really interesting that we pick PDF all the time, for example, and we might do really well and pick OO, what's the dreadful document format. We don't seem to... What is it? OO. Yeah. Oh, XML. We just don't seem to be able to get it right very often, do we? Okay, so what happened to HTML when the web came along and Tim thought about how to make HTML was obviously he just took sort of HTML but said you need much less of it. So that was a good idea. He said you can ship your content around and you can just have a way of telling it how it should be presented. And, you know, with great pride, he said you can have a black background if you want to, a white background, because you separate those things. And quickly we got castigating style sheets, and the idea of being able to play with presentation without messing up content, as you know. And that was quite a good idea, because when he suddenly realized that Mosaic and the GUI interface had caused the serious problems, and that the web, unlike the rest of computing at that point, was becoming inaccessible. So up until the point of the web, generally people with disabilities were doing fairly well. They had teletext and all sorts of other ways they could do things. But once we saw everything move on to being driven by the mouse, we suddenly saw a really bad time come about for people with disabilities, either because their motor coordination wasn't good enough, or because they couldn't see, or they couldn't hear, or something like that. And so what happened then was, something's gone to sleep in my computer. Here we are. That was my thing. So that we had to do something about the fact that this notion of just separating presentation from content wasn't working because the introduction of the GUI. And I think that when they set up the World Wide Web Initiative, what they didn't do is actually think that bit out carefully enough. So the idea that the World Wide Web Accessibility Initiative has worked on for a long time is that if you separate content from presentation, you solve all problems. Unfortunately, I'm not going to give you a long argument about it, but unfortunately it hasn't worked. 10 years down the track, it's time to think a bit harder about what's going on. Basically, what W3C did was start up with what seemed like the important three pieces of the story, make sure that the authoring tools not only are accessible to people with disabilities, but that you can get authoring tools for making web content that are accessible to people with disabilities, that produce content that's accessible to people with disabilities, without having to think about it. There's a certain word processor product that you might use to make a web page. Have a look at that web page, I'm sure you all have, and have a look at how dreadful the HTML in there is. And then think about how many people just can't access that page. Looks the same, it's only useful to about 3% of the people. So it's only 3% of it is accessible to everyone. The UAG guidelines are guidelines for browsers. And, you know, you can see the competition came in straight away as fast as they could. Some companies made their browsers different. People who had a monopoly of the market therefore made everyone want to design to those different browsers. And that's been a significant problem. But there are 35 major browsers in the world, I think. When you live in Australia, you think there are two or three. I find that I'm in Europe, people just say, what are you talking about? No. We use this or this or this or this. And actually, if you look at companies like Opera, they have a huge effect now because they're on all the mobile devices. And they are standards compliant. And they do care about accessibility. So again, if you're working in an institution that says you need to use IE or even worse, Lookout, what are you going to do about that? Ask our friendly Microsoft people to help us. Or think again. Don't laugh. They might. I've worked alongside Microsoft people who worked really hard on accessibility for years, but it's a battle in that company because that's not the company's main focus. Again, the thing I think that's interesting is that HTML for what we think of as web pages, HTML 4.1 is the only one that you should ever be using if you are still using straight HTML. But organisations who've moved to XML, who've at least got those HTML pages as XHTML, make an enormous difference to people with disabilities. There is so much that can be done to a page that's properly formatted in XML. There's not a lot that can be done to content that's in HTML. So it's a really important thing to make sure that people's standards, without any effort, the XHTML standard, or XML as you know. And then the other thing that's important is to make sure that, for example, images do grow, that things are coordinated. If I have to slip in an audio file with a description of an image, I need that synchronized with something else that's happening. So I need to use those standard languages and W3C produce a really broad range of them, and that's fantastic work. So I really applaud the work that W3C do. It's just that I think, unfortunately, we, and I take responsibility for this too, we thought that separating presentation from content would be all we'd have to do. It's a lot harder than that. So, given that, we've been pretty bad. In 10 years, we've worked on accessibility and we've achieved 3%. It's a figure that makes me want to cry when I go to bed. You know, it's really tragic that this stuff is not accessible to people. We've had to stop and think again, what's wrong, what's going on here, and what's happening and why. So some of us who've worked on metadata have started a different approach, at least, to the accessibility problem, a complementary approach, but I think an important one that can make a really big difference. Metadata is just information about information. You can have metadata if you like. It's information about information about information, and so on. Catalogue records, the list of ingredients on a can of soup, those sort of things are all metadata. But we tend to use the word metadata if it's machine readable, if there's some way that there's some sort of consistency about it, and so we can tell a machine to do something with it. So it's really nothing new, it's just in its new form, and obviously it's not going to be useful metadata if it's not made in a common language with common standards so that everybody can look at other people's metadata, share metadata and make sense of it. My way of thinking about metadata is to think about what we're trying to organise. What I do in my house is I open up the drawers and I put the socks in the left-hand top cut drawer and the underpants in the right-hand one. I put the shirts in the next one. I put the sweaters in the next one. I put the pants in the bottom one. I know where the socks are and I know where the underpants are because that's the method I use. And it works mostly except for all those things that are still on the floor. Getting a little bit more organised in an office where you've got too many things and they're too different, you do that with a filing cabinet generally. You put stuff in a filing cabinet, you give it a number, and then you set up some other small place that tells you where you need to look for something. With metadata labels, you can actually do a bit of sorting without pulling the things out. You can find all the red ones, all the blue ones, all the ones that are size 12, because you actually have that information. And so the way I used to deal with my kids, because I have four, is they literally had, I had different colours for different sizes. So you're blue size now, and this one's red size. And it was all the undies could go in the same drawer, blue for you and red for you. So metadata labels are really easy way of handling things without having to touch them. If we make those metadata labels clear and write them in a common language, and particularly in a common language which is atomic enough for computers to work with it, then we can get computers to do the sorting for us. If we just have free tags and lovely descriptions of everything, machines can't handle it. But if we know that we're going to have colour, size, condition, clean or dirty, something or other, we can then set a machine to work through those tags. So resource description framework labels are simply labels which have a structure that is very simple. They're a subject, predicate, object structure. Name is Liddy. Parent is John. Son is Charles. That very, very simple structure can be built into quite complex sentences, but the advantage of it is that it can be done by a machine. So RDF is simply a way of making the description of something very, very small so that complexity can be handled by machines. Currently, we think of RDF as XML very often, but it doesn't have to be XML. If something else comes about in some other time, we have a different way of different file format, that won't matter. The notion of having very simple sentences, having objects with properties, is one that will, I don't know what the big word is, go over different formats in the future. So we're very keen to make sure that our labels are things that we can really use into the future. And once we've got that situation, we can start to group things in interesting ways. So many of us are quite keen to see this system get that sophistication. Instead of having to put together a different CV every time I want to tell someone about something. I'd like to have a system that can just go and pull out my academic records, my publications, my home address, my current work place, my five most recent articles, whatever people want, and just send the machine off to find those things. What I have to do now is fossick through all of this stuff every time, and even worse, if I want to get a passport, I have to go and get a photograph from somewhere and this piece of information from my boss and something else. There are much better ways to do things where we put machines to work. But metadata will only work if we have a common language so that we can exchange those records. And the aim is to share the information about the resources so that other people can use their systems to fossick through my records to find out if I've got what they want. And similarly, actually to save them making records about stuff they've got. If we've both got a book about Shakespeare, surely the record about the book will be the same. So why would you bother to catalogue something that's already been catalogued by someone else? And of course, that's what's happening in the library world at large. So it makes a lot of sense if that's happening in the library of the web. It's small, let's say. Okay, so there are many standards for describing metadata, for describing resources. Some of them are very specific to education, let's say. That's the IMS LOM for describing learning objects. There's the JTC 1 SC36 metadata for learning resources. There's the EDNA way of doing it. There's the ARROW way of doing it. Crucial thing is the interoperable. People who use metadata really get the message about interoperability. If you don't make it so that you can swap with the others, you alienate yourself on a distant island and you don't have much fun. So metadata people, even if they have stuff that's specific to their context, work very hard to make sure that it's clear how to get from one context to another. So the difference between LOM and the MLR is probably in the detail. In fact, it will be in the detail because we're working to make sure it is. We'll at least be able to swap what is the thing about, who made it, when was it made, where can I get it from, how much does it cost, all of that sort of information. There'll be at least common core stuff that we can swap around. Then there are general standards, which are really those common core ones I've just talked about, that apply to all sorts of things, green gloves, books, people, and so on. And particularly, I don't know if you know, but Australia has standards for describing resources. They're called the Australian Government Locator Service, or NAS standard. And that standard requires you to describe every resource so that people can actually find out if that's the resource they want before they get it. And it's about to introduce a need for a description of the accessibility of the resource as well. So in the revised version of that next year, we'll see coming out a particular element where you put what is this resource, so that somebody can say, well, it's no good to me, that resource, because I'm blind, or because I have a low-level connection, I use the barbed wire fence or something. We have different kinds of descriptions. We have very sophisticated ones based on MARC and things like that coming from the Library of Congress, you know, $50 to write down all of this complicated stuff, and we have very lightweight descriptions, just title, author, whatever, which can be pulled out of the machine quite often without any effort at all. And as you know, we're now getting round to having social tagging. The trick about social tagging is we're not quite sure what to do with it yet. We know that with social tagging we're getting to understand better the words that people use, but we also know that people are not very consistent, even themselves. It's a lovely project called Steve where people are putting tags on museum objects, and when they walk past them in the museum they might say painting black dress, because that's what strikes them. When they go home they try and look for that painting by Renoir. You tagged it and yet you've changed your perspective on it. So people do that so we still don't know how to get the full benefit of that, but clearly there's a lot of human effort going into tagging things, and that's the important thing. So we want to be able to capture that and use it somehow, but so far it's not really standardised in any clear way. Okay, so what we're doing in accessibility that's different is saying, look, what approach has been taken up till now is to say that people should produce every resource so every potential user can get full access to it. Just in case somebody needs something. That's what the law actually says. Just in case somebody who's blind wants to look at this, you'll have to have a version for them. You'll have to have a version for someone who's deaf. You'll have to have a version for somebody who's got motor coordination problem. You'll have to have a version for somebody who's got low bandwidth. You'll have to have a version for crazy. And we don't do it, and that's why we've got the 3%. And the other thing that we think is crazy is that if I have a disability, for example, I'm driving the car and I want an audio output, I don't care, to be honest, whether Fred Merck wants something else. It's actually not a problem for me. All I want to know is, can I get what I need? Now, under the current system, at best you'll be told this is accessible or not accessible. What's that mean? I'm not interested in 97%. I'm interested in just me. I might be a Braille reader as a blind person, or I might not be able to read Braille. How can you say what will be accessible to me? How do you know my level of abilities? How do you know the context that I'm in? So we think that the bus has been missed completely by trying to solve the problem for everyone in a uniform way. And so what we're trying to do is say that accessibility means that each individual person who requires access to a resource can get that access just in time. Now, that may mean that they can get it immediately, or it may mean that something has to be done to give it to them. But at least there's a way of finding out if it's going to work for them and a way of finding out how to make it work for them. The advantage of this is also one that allows more people to participate in the exercise. Currently, to make something accessible, the original author has to do 1,000 things. So what happens in institutions? We're sitting in Melbourne University here. It's a good example. Melbourne University hands out templates to the academics. You will use this template to produce your stuff. Yep, say the academics. It just doesn't work. And particularly if people know what they're doing, why do they want to be told this is how you put stuff on the page? I mean, this is really, really weird. It's like being given a biro for half an hour. You know, now you put it back and later on you can have another turn. It just seems to me extraordinary that in the institutions that most of us and the organisations that most of us work in, that we are treated like half-wits when it comes to producing information, and we're mainly experts in producing information. How extraordinary. We wouldn't do that with pens. Why do we do it with software? Well, we need 50 years to get this thing right, don't we? So I think that this notion that you can make stuff accessible to everyone is basically pretty crazy. But if you think about the components that go into your resources, and at least you can describe the components, then somebody looking at a resource, or by a resource, it may mean a service. I don't necessarily mean something you read. It may be a service, it may be Second Life or something. At least you can tell people what's going to be in there. And if you get somebody, let's say, who's blind, who's wanting to use Second Life, then you could say to them, well, you won't be able to do it, but you can call this phone number. Or by tomorrow we could print you out a version, or whatever. We provide a way of having other people able to come after the event and provide better facilities than are made by the original author. And if we handle those additional or complementary or supplementary pieces well, then when Melbourne University has the problem that somebody wants to listen to something, it's probably going to occur at Monash as well, and possibly at the University of New South Wales. So if somebody's made an alternative and they've described the alternative as an oral version of an image, let's say, then that can be found by people who in other places as well, and shared. So we start to share the resources, the special resources that take extra work to make them. So we're trying to say, how can we look at individual needs and preferences just in time to produce the requirements that people have? Now, this is just a slide I like to put up, and it's terribly out of date. But, you know, it used to work 10 years ago when the web came around, people forget that even when you sit at a single screen, or sit at a screen and it looks like you're seeing the same thing, everybody fiddles with their web browser. And you get umpteen versions of the same thing. It's no longer sensible for publishers or resource producers to dictate to us how we should see stuff. It just isn't the way we're going to be doing things in the future. Currently, it is what happens. As much as people can control it, but they can't control it because we all know how to break the technology. And so it's a silly idea that's going to take a few years to go away, I'd say, but it's on its way. Okay, so this is the sort of thing that happens in the University of Toronto nowadays. When a student comes along and wants to do some work, they log into Tile, the inclusive learning exchange. It's inclusive because it doesn't say if you've got disability or what's your disability, it just says come in students. Students come in, they log into Tile. Here's, I love this student because she's a real little conch. I remember people like that when I was at university. They did their homework quickly and then they were out partying every night and they got top marks. You know, there are people like that. She just wants the hardcore quick, what do I have to know? I'll learn it quickly and then I'll be on somewhere else. And that's the kind of person she is, and she's entitled to be that kind of person. But her mate, she's much more the type that I understand, sitting outside, fooling around, talking, having coffee, doesn't want too much stuff given to him at once, needs a dark background because he's reading in the sun after all, and he hasn't got a little XI machine, so he has the problem of being outside. We have another person who's actually not on campus at all. She doesn't like working by herself off campus, so she likes to be online with people when she's doing exactly the same work as those other two people. So people have different ways of wanting to do their work. And Tile just doesn't ask who or why or, you know, justify yourself. It just says, oh, okay, well, you'd like this combination, and you'd like this combination, and you'd like this combination, and gives it to people. And, you know, we find our smart little girl saying, ooh, I'm nearly there, I've nearly got rid of all this work. And so she's buzzing along through her stuff in this way. But her friend doesn't want to do it that way. And her friend, who sits outside sometimes actually goes home and has his dad look over his shoulder, and he has to look like he's doing university work. So all he does in Tile is go in and change the preferences and needs that he has. And then it comes out differently. And somebody who's watching a video and can't hear because you're not allowed to have sound in the library can immediately get captions on. Now this is the sort of thing that we should see happening. This is open source, by the way. This is really worth looking at. This thing has been running in University of Toronto now for some years and is a really interesting system. Okay, so what's going on there is that we're matching resources to people's personal needs and preferences. We talk about needs and preferences. Needs are things that you can't get round. I can stop my car and do my SMS properly. Of course, I always do. Preferences are what I'd like to have. So people can usually swap with their preferences, but they have no choice with their needs. Are you telling me I've run out of time? I'm really getting quite quickly there, but I just want to show you this. Is that all right?
Yeah.
I've been here for 38 minutes. I was told to be here for 50. So the three things that we broke it up into when we looked at digital objects, purely digital objects being accessible to people, were the display, the presentation, whether it's oral or visual or whatever, the control of it, because quite often how you control the resource changes according to your context or whatever, or how you can control it, and the content itself, if it's in the wrong language and so on. So we looked at, those are the three categories that we've given to the needs and preferences that people have. And where they can't see text, they might need to have it transformed into Braille, for example. That's a typical thing. Or you might want bigger text or different colour. The control sort of thing. A lot of assistive technologies, by the way, just work as if there's no problem. They just plug in and things run properly. On the other hand, we know that when we use some devices, like me using my telephone, the things really change on the control sense, and we have to have special configurations. And if we have an on-screen keyboard, we'll have half the screen used up anyway. So we're going to have special versions even of what goes on the screen. And content's a really interesting one, and we haven't got very far with this yet, but we know that, for example, a dyslexic person will probably not want a lot of stuff on the screen at once, whereas somebody else might find it very useful not to have any images. A dyslexic person might want more diagrams. So there are significant variations in there, and we've set up a hierarchy where you can say, no, I'm happy with whatever. I have a need in terms of control, or I have a need in terms of display. And if it gets to be that you're using some very special device, you get down to the nitty-gritty tiny details of how big the keys should be on the screen. On the other hand, if that's not important to you, you don't have to worry about it. So setting up your personal needs and preferences description needn't be a burdensome thing, but it's something that can get into enormous detail. And the sort of typical example is to have needs and preferences description for when I'm displaying stuff up here. I want the font to be big. However, if I'm going to give that presentation to somebody and they might be looking at home on their own computer, they don't want huge font. They don't want to sit there and have a PowerPoint display. They just want something that's going to be small. So we could imagine an individual having a number of what we call PNPs. So I might have the PNP when I'm lecturing, the PNP when I'm at home, the PNP for my palm, PNP for my telephone. If I had a disability, I might have one for early in the day, late in the day, when I'm at the university and when I'm at home. So we imagine people. This is not a description of a person. This is a description of the needs and preferences that you want to use at the time. And that's a really, really important thing. We are not into labelling people at all. And they're shareable. If I'm giving a lecture, and the university set up a really nice PNP, why don't I just use that one? There's no reason to be prescriptive about that. So that's the first thing. We think that people ought to be able to choose what they want, not be told by some website, text bigger, text medium, text small. We've decided that you are not in our audience. You know, this is the kind of stuff that I think is happening that really frightens me. Let people choose what they want, and then respond to that. So the description of resources, and we're talking here, as I said, about services as well as what you might think of as document-like objects and so on, you have to match those with a description of the accessibility features of that match the personal needs and preferences pile. So again, it's the display, the control, and the content of the resource. Now, where people are producing special alternative formats, they're going to put more information on than the average person. If you just produce a resource and you've got a resource which is an image, or perhaps you've got something which has got some text and an image, it's not going to take you very long to put a label on it that says text and image. It's going to make an enormous difference to people who are looking for you at your resource. If you do it in a consistent way, if you use proper metadata to do that, their machines will be able to sift through for them. So all we're really looking for is this very, very basic information in a machine-readable way, and that'll make it possible for people who happen to have the tile-type system to sift through it. It'll also make it possible for people who have to use Google and so on to make those choices sensibly. But as I say, people who know a lot about these accessibility needs, who are making special alternative formats, they'll add more metadata later on. We're very keen that people think about labelling their resources in an atomic way. It's not really terribly useful to people with disabilities to be told this page has images, it has sound, it has tactile stuff attached to it, it has all of those things. It's really much more helpful to be told here's a composite page, this is a visual file, this is a text file, this is a something file. So that's the sort of flexibility that Fairfax are using, and that's why they're saving money in transmission, because they can actually ship out just the components that people want. So looking at components within content is a really useful thing to do. And I think it fits very well into the sort of thing that you guys are all interested in doing. Very flexible pages, let's have Ajax, let's have this, let's have that, let's ship around what people want, let's ship it around the way they want it, let's give people some power in the system. So that's really what we're trying to garnish here. We're saying the old HTML approach, the simple approach, doesn't work in the flexible modern world that we've got. And so that's why we want people to talk about these deep, these objects. And then if you've got little objects that you can swap around with people, that's going to make it easier for everyone because you won't have to produce them yourself. Now, the first bit of the Access for All model that we developed was to do with digital resources. And people came along and said, yeah, but what about when you have a mixture of digital resources and you've got someone that can help you? So, for example, in UK schools, they were concerned that they wanted to know whether this resource needs an assistant, a human assistant, if a student has a particular need. And what sort of human supplements need to be available or are available online and so on. So we started with a pair of things, the description of the needs and preferences for digital resources and the matching pair, which was the description of the resources for digital. Another pair came along, the pair being mixed resources. I'm involved in writing one which is to do with the events and places, descriptions of events and places. If I go to this place and I have a wheelchair, will I be able to get in? And if I try to go to the opera and I'm deaf, will I be able to hear? So we've got part 6 and 7. We've got another part coming on, which is about the way languages, if from this language to another language, the translation is not simply changing words, of course. The structure of languages is critical. And so you can translate to some languages and you really can't translate to others automatically. So this Access for All idea is a new approach to put the focus on the individual and to look at the needs and preferences for that kind of resource and match it up. And it comes in pairs like that. Okay, the matching process is easy in an enclosed environment like Tile is operating in. University of Toronto, they actually do produce all the components that their students might need and then they assemble them on the fly to satisfy the needs and profiles of the student. It's a fantastic problem when you look at it in a distributed way. Suppose I bring down a resource which has got an image in it, there's not a text description of the image. I want that resource to be transformed by my machine so that instead of the image I get a description of the image that isn't produced by the original author. Can I search on the web to find a description of that image which can be substituted for that picture before the thing is delivered to me? And I have to tell you, I had a lot of fun because I actually tried it with the ABC video on demand or whatever it was, and I looked up for something, a news item, and then I thought, that's interesting. Here's a picture. Let's pretend I can't see the picture. Can I find a description of that incident? And yes, I could, because the metadata that the ABC have for their atomic elements is so good that I simply grabbed the metadata and put it into Google and found a description of the picture. And my machine could have done that for me because the ABC does their work properly. So that's really cool, and that's what we're hoping to find. The benefits of this approach is that we care about individuals instead of people in bulk. Inaccessible content, in the general sense, might be very accessible for me. We don't know how to make content or services that are accessible to everyone, so we ought to be able to tell people whether they're going to be able to get it or not. We can share the load of making things accessible. If you're in a school and you're trying to provide opportunities for a student and you don't happen to have an accessible version of something, chances are there's one out there that's slightly different but will be suitable. Much better than having to say, as you would in an English school, we can't do it. Because if you can't provide to everyone in an English school, you're not allowed to do it at all. Publishers can share their efforts, and we are about to build a digital repository to have catalogue records of alternative formats. And if you're interested in participating in that with us so far is University and TAFE institutions, Vision Australia and I Trust Edna. We're looking at where can you register an alternative format object that might be useful in education. There isn't a place at the moment, so we want to do that. So you'll need to send me an email and I can put you on the discussion list if you're interested in doing that. We can have people making resources and other people providing accessible versions of them. And because it's metadata, you don't have to go back to the original author and get permission. You simply have to put in the catalogue record, hey, by the way, that inaccessible resource has an accessible version over here. Don't tell me about the problem of copyright, I'm aware of that, it is a problem, but at least you know who to contact. And you may have to get around the... And we're talking about inclusion. We're talking about everybody equally. We're not talking about people with disabilities as if they're something different. We are all people with disabilities at times. And that's the way we should be treating people with disabilities, I think. So, that's the end of my talk now, and it's 50 minutes and 2 seconds. but I think there's a lot that I would hope that you people could get involved with and help with that. Some of us get involved in doing standards and we really need to be dragged down to the ground and told this doesn't work for us in practice. I think that this approach is going to work in practice much better than the earlier approaches and the expectation that people could do everything accessibly. But it will require everybody getting everybody aware of the fact that currently we're living in a world where it's very exclusive. Not just that we don't all know how to do open source stuff, we couldn't even access the thing if we tried. That's a tragedy, I think. Okay, that's the end.
Thank you.
Now, if you do want to contact me about that digital repository, my email address is liddy@sunriseresearch.org. Liddy, L-I-D-D-Y, Sunrise Research is one word, sunriseresearch.org. If you send me an email with digital repository as the subject line, I will point you to how you can hook up to that. And what we're doing is looking at different people getting involved, helping us do it. We hope that we'll build this catalogue as a technical exercise fairly quickly, and the real work will be people registering that they've got a nice picture or a description of a picture or something. Roland.
I've been in touch with migration with the Subject Association and FITES database about 3,000 objects that have been all requiring some advice about metadata tagging structure.
Good.
Something that we're working with top media business, but
well, there are actually sort of two schools of metadata in the education world, but mostly in Australia we're doing what we call Dublin Core metadata, which is fairly lightweight, simply says, you know, who's the author, what's the date, stuff like that. And then we're trying to build a Dublin Core version of this, and all that you will do is perhaps say this is, a bad text, Microsoft text, for example, you would have to put bad text, or you could say this is textual, meaning that it's nice standards compliant text which people can spin out onto a braille device or read through JAWS or whatever. So it could be very, very simple for you simply to add just one or two little tags to each thing. All of your images, it's worth actually tagging them as visual, because one of the things that happens is people have a picture of a gravestone. And, you know, so you're meant to read it, but it's an image. So the person with a vision disability needs to be told this is an image of text. So this is not textual. You'll need to get an alternative somewhere to find out what's in it. So you could go through your stuff, I think, remarkably quickly, even if it's 3,000. You could go through it very quickly. So you just need to keep nagging me. If you want to know more about this thing, go to the Dublin Core site, which is dublincore.org. And then this is the accessibility group, which is where we're making the Dublin Core version. We've made the ISO version, which I think is much more complicated than any of you want to deal with. But so I think it's the Dublin Core version that's going to be adopted as the Australian AGLS version as well. So if you go there and perhaps put yourself on the mailing list, and hopefully in the next month I will actually give you the answer to your question. But it's a little bit messy right this week, I admit.
Yeah, I'd like to get it right, because it seems like the first words and it seems like it's adopted by other subjects.
Yeah, and most organisations in this country who have databases, who are managing their information, have Dublin Core database structure or something that matches to it.
Okay.
So it's not a big thing. I don't think it's a big thing to ask you just to add one more element and to put this sort of stuff in. It'll fit in, I think, pretty well. And if you don't have that, you've probably got IMS stuff that will fit into that too. So I feel that Australia's a country where we could actually get this metadata up and running pretty quickly.